Welcome to On Topic, a series of conversations hosted by Baylor President Ken Starr. In this installment, Starr talks with political commentator David Brooks. This conversation took place on Wednesday, March 2, 2016.
David Brooks, by my lights and building on what our dear Betsy Vardaman said, he is the leading public intellectual and writer of our time. That's a matter of opinion, but that's mine. We heard from virtually countless people during the course of his afternoon visit that they avidly read with admiration and with profit his column. And as Dean Vardaman also indicated, in addition to his television commentary, and a number of people said they saw him very late. He said, how'd he get here? He was on very late last night in light of Super Tuesday. But he's written those books that she identified, and we'll be talking about this, which is a must-read. By the way, it's available for sale, and David will be available for a period after this gathering. This is The Road to Character. I've read every word of it. It is magnificent. And so, my fellow students, as I like to call my fellow lifelong learners, you're in for a great, great treat. So again, join me as we join Betsy Vardaman in saying, David, welcome to Baylor University.
Thank you. thank you. Let me just start by saying what a pleasure it is to be here with Ken Starr, the nicest human being on the face of the earth. It's a great pleasure to be interviewed by Ken. It would have been a greater pleasure to be interviewed by Chip and Joanna Gaines, but I'll take what I can get.
and I agree. It would have been, I'd be happy to be out there. Well, thank you. By the way, you too can get a fixer upper. You need a Waco home on the banks of the Brazos to get away from Washington and New York. Well, David, of course, it's a presidential year. Yesterday was Super Tuesday, maybe a couple of surprises. But it's also been an unusually, at least by my observation, ugly campaign, especially on the Republican side. So you're an observer. You've been watching this. What is this telling you about the state of American politics, and what's it telling you about we, the American people?
Yeah, it has been an ugly period, but I remember the first debate when Donald Trump, he just insulted Carly Fiorina for the way she looked, and he turned to Rand Paul, and he said, I'm not going to insult his looks, but there's a lot for me to work there if I want to. And at that moment, all these taboos went crashing down. And so I think what he was signaling was that he wasn't only opposing the establishment for policies, but for manners. And he was going to crash through and provide an anti-politeness. He worked in the world of professional wrestling for 25 years. He's in the Professional Wrestling Hall of Fame. And he has taken the language and lingo of professional wrestling and brought it to the world of politics and smashed all the rules of politeness and the rules of civility, those that were left. But I think the big story that's happening is that every 40 or 50 years, the American political landscape shifts. I think Ronald Reagan was a shift. I think Franklin Roosevelt was a shift. And frankly, if Trump gets the nomination, I think he's a shift. And he will change the Republican Party fundamentally. Some of the policies will be changed, things like trade policy and immigration policy. But the big shift will be it'll be a less ideological party and more of a nationalist party. It'll be less of a broad party and frankly more of a white party. And so I think most shifts, like Reagan or Roosevelt, broaden the parties they start from, or like Lincoln with the Republican Party. But Trump is narrowing the Republican Party to much more less ideological, less philosophical, less opportunity-oriented, and more blood and soil, old-style European authoritarian conservatism, in my view. And so that is just a gigantic seismic change in our politics. Mm.
What's it telling you about the American people? At least a lot of folks are responding.
Yeah, well, a lot of people have been disenfranchised, and a lot of people have lost jobs, they've lost status, They see the demography of the country changing. They see globalization happening. They see a very top-heavy economy. But the big shift in one of values. The trait that correlates most strongly with Trump support is the trait which people test for in studies called authoritarianism. A disbelief. Politics, we live in a diverse society. And because we live in a diverse society, there are two ways to run ourselves. One is called democracy, where we acknowledge each other and we try to hash out ugly deals with each other. And it's filled with disappointment, but it's also filled with conversation. The other is with authority and violence, the imposition of order. And a lot of people are just disgusted with politics, and then they want something else. And so he seems like a bully. And so I'm not too positive, and maybe there are Trump supporters here in the room. But I do think it's a turn that will hurt the Republican Party and, frankly, hurt the Republic. Mm.
On the Democratic side, the phenomenon of Bernie Sanders, he did not have a great night last night, but he still carried several states. And going back, now seems like a long time ago, but Iowa, New Hampshire, he overwhelmingly carried the vote of the millennials, those who are 30 years of age or under. What's your sense of what's happened to, and is happening to, the rising generation in light of the senators' positions?
Yeah, well, they don't know what they're talking about. No, I'm just kidding. Well, one thing is true, they haven't paid taxes yet, so they don't know what an 80% tax rate is. but, you know, it's hard to graduate with debt into this economy. It's just hard. And it's true of Trump, and it's true of the millennials in different ways. Trump does extremely well with people without college degrees. He does horribly with people with college degrees. In Virginia last night, he got only 28% of those votes. But but those are two groups, the young and people without college degrees, who face a daunting economy. And so it's basically, the American system is basically not working for them, and they're looking for alternatives. And that I totally get. And so, to graduate today, you know, I teach at a different school.
we'll come to that.
In New Haven, sort of the Baylor of the Northeast. And we were talking about student life. They have daunting job prospects, even at Yale. They have social anarchy in their dating life. There are no rules, there are no customs, there's a hint of savagery in the way they treat each other, frankly. And there's distrust. It used to be that if you ask people, do you trust most of the people around you? For decade after decade, a majority said, yes, I do. Mm. Now, it's like 25% say, yes, I trust most of the people around me. Mm. And the group that is most trusting is baby boomers. The group with least amount of social trust for people around them are millennials. The younger you go, the more cynical you get. And that's just weird. And I've talked to a lot of my students about this phenomenon, and they say, have you seen our dating lives? That there's just a lot of mistreatment out there. And so that combined with the economic anxiety creates this desire for something different.
The Sanders phenomenon, so it will likely continue. He may not win, but
if you look at,
he's giving just, voice to...
Yeah, if you look at the ideological shifts in the electorate, the Republican Party moved right a while ago. The Democratic Party is just moving left in the last 5-10 years. Mm.
Does that suggest that there is a place for a third party, the Independence Party?
Yeah, well, the obvious candidate would be Mike Bloomberg. And he has always thought about running, though, as he says, how many 5'6" New York Jewish guys do you know who've won presidency? but I think it's a long shot. Our party just makes that very hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's looked at running, and there's no way. The country is still very partisan. Most states will go for a Republican or a Democrat. So I don't think there's room for a third party. But as the Republican Party fractures, which it's about to do, then those people have to go somewhere. And they're not going to go to a Bernie Sanders party. So I'm not quite sure what will happen, but we're in for a period of seismic shifting. Mm.
Switching to the Article 3 branch, the death unexpected. He was 79 years old, to be sure. He lived a great and rich, abundant life in full. Justice Antonin Scalia passed away, as you know, right here in the state of Texas on a hunting weekend trip. Your colleague, Ross Douthat, of the New York Times, wrote this within hours of the announcement of the justices passing from this life. There are few professional conservatives who have not been influenced in some sense by Scalia's words, his writing, his mind. So he's not talking about the law alone. So reflect with us, if you will, on your view as you reflect on Nino Scalia, as he was affectionately called, on his passing and his enduring legacy in American culture as well as American law.
First, let me pay tribute to my colleague, Ross Douthat, for getting that out so fast. My joke about being a conservative columnist in the New York Times is it's like being the chief rabbi at Mecca. There's not a lot of company there. But now I have Ross as a stablemate.
Wait, that can be dangerous. You're not only alone, that can be dangerous.
So now there's Ross and I, so we should actually have factional fights, just the two of us, and not talk to each other. You know, I know nothing about the law. I've never written about Supreme Court. So I knew Scalia only as someone who enjoyed life and was at parties that I was at. And out of that, I saw wine, I heard lots of tales of poker playing, and I saw a richness of light combined with acerbic comments to me about my squishiness. But I would say, I'm reminded when I look at him, and I'm really impressed by the court. Again, I don't know it legally, but if you're around the Washington party scene, you know, nightclubs, 2 a.m, as I am, then you run into the justices. You're smashed out of their minds. Now, this is the 5 to 7 p.m. And they all get along, and I think genuine. You see genuine friendship, and in a city that's so polarized, to see their relationships with one another and the tenderness with which they treat each other, it's just nice. And they're all so smart and interesting, and I would say unassuming. Mm-hmm. Kagan, Sotomayor, is like this golden figure, just this deeply good person. Justice Breyer. I was once at a conference, and I mused from the panel. I don't know the answer to this question, but it'd be an interesting question. I can't remember what it was, but I raised some question. He comes up to me about an hour later after I get off the panel, and he says, I don't know the answer to your question, but here's how you might think about it. And he hands me these two pieces of paper with like a 13-step decision tree. I was like, wow, that is a big brain. And with Scalia, there's a quote from a hero of mine named Walter Badgett. If you want to convert people to your cause, you can write boring policy tracts. But if you really, and you might have some small influence, but probably not. If you really want to win people over, try a little pleasure. Be seen enjoying life in your way. And people will be attracted to the pleasure of the life. And Scalia sort of personified that.
Well, speaking of polarization, the president and Majority Leader McConnell met yesterday in the White House and apparently did not come to an agreement. Your take on the situation, the president's right, obviously, to nominate the Senate's advice and consent function. Your reflection on what seems to be unfolding.
Yeah, so I've spent the last 3 minutes trying to figure out what you would say to that question. I don't know if it's fair to ask you, because as a university president, you probably have 9 million ways of dodging it. But,
He knows.
My instinct is that it would be that you're elected president and you get to nominate. And it's not, you don't get to nominate for 3 years out of a 4-year term, you get to nominate for 4 years. And in my view, the Senate should take it up as they would any other nomination. Your view. You know, no, never mind.
Well, I said this immediately after Nino's death in interview. I said, I think a generation ago, the president would have summoned the leadership of the Senate, both sides, over and said, look, this is a very difficult year. It's a presidential year. Let's talk this through. I think that would have been helpful if the relationship had been there so you could have had that conversation. Now, that may seem like a backroom Washington, D.C. deal, but there's nothing that says that the president cannot consult with the Senate very early on and say, I'm soliciting your views. But especially with a very polarized court right now, even though I completely agree with what you said about there's a gentility about the court, even though they disagree, and sometimes they disagree vehemently, they nonetheless get along with one another and genuinely like one another, is illustrated by Ruth Ginsburg and now the late Nino Scalia, voted opposite on virtually all of the really major issues, other than perhaps First Amendment. Both Ruth and Nino were pretty libertarian when it came to First Amendment kinds of issues, but that didn't happen, and so here, weeks later, they get together and agree to disagree. So I think in a different age, I just think, what would LBJ have done under these circumstances? Now, that didn't work out so well in terms of Abe Fortas, but that's another subject.
Well dodged, sir, well dodged.
Well, we need to hold this up again. This is such a wonderful book, honestly. The Road to Care, well, I've got all kinds of post-its here, and it's been so well received. It actually was number one on the New York Times bestseller list. Well, let me begin by asking, what prompted you, David, to write the book?
Okay. First, before, one of the things I like about coming to Texas is somebody puts a Dr. Pepper in your hand every 15 minutes. Could I ask somebody backstage to bring out some water? We don't have water out here.
So. Yeah, I think you should have some at the, no?
Ah, never yeah. mind.
Yeah, we played a trick on it.
Wow.
Would Thank you like you. A Dr. Pepper instead?
No. I first heard about Dr. Pepper from George H.W. Bush,
who
was a big six-pack-a-day guy. obviously, health benefits are amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. parachuting out of airplanes at the age of 85.
Yeah, yeah. one Bush story, if I can. Two Bush stories. One is related. The book is about the rise of narcissism a bit. And when George H.W. Bush was running for office in 1988, his staff would beat him up to say, you got to talk about yourself, brag. You're an amazing guy, brag about how great you are. And he refused to do it because he hadn't been raised in a certain culture. And so he, one day, he accepted the passage in the speech. He gave a speech talking about how great he was. And his mom, who was then still alive, called him up and said, George, you're talking about yourself again. And so that's sort of a different culture. I wrote the book in part because, I say in there, and it's sort of true to save my own soul. I mean, it's more than sort of true, it is true. There are certain people you meet who just radiate joy. They have God's grace upon them, and it radiates out of them. And I had achieved way more career success than I had ever thought I would. But I did not have that joy. And I didn't have the sort of soul you would be proud of. And so you feel a gap, and you feel an inadequacy, and you feel sort of a moral mediocrity, that you grade yourself on a forgiving curve. You're not really living up to the highest ideals. And it's not only being stern and man of rectitude, but not having the joy. And occasionally you see people who have it. I mean, the famous person I talk about who I met who has it is famously the Dalai Lama, where I was seated next to him at a luncheon in Washington at the place called the American Enterprise Institute. And he's a guy who laughs for no apparent reason. He's just so peaceful and joyful. He just busts out laughing. And I'm sitting next to him at this luncheon. I'm trying to be polite, so he busts out laughing, and I bust out laughing, and you want to laugh alongside, and you try to insert a joke, like, to just justify the laughter. And so I'm awkwardly, and he's having a great old time by himself laughing. And I'm all nervous, so he's got this little canvas Dalai Lama bag, And I ask him, you got any candy in your bag? And he starts pulling out all the stuff in the bag. And it's basically everything you get in the first class cabin of an international flight. And so it's a little razor, earpiece, you know, little eye, and a big Toblerone bar. But he radiates that joy. And I didn't have it, still don't have it, but wanted to know how people get it. Mm. And so I wanted to find people, and the book is really a series of portraits of 10 or so people who really were pathetic at age 20, but were kind of magnificent by age 70. And they passed moral tests, and they confronted their own sinfulness, and they radiated love by the end.
If you read this, and I've read every word of this book, you will say, I'm a grandparent, this needs to be read by grandchildren. And especially in light of what you said about the rising generation, this probably should be assigned reading. And indeed, it is being used at least one school here in the Waco area. What do you hope, that was the personal side of why you wrote it. What do you hope grandparents, grandchildren, and everybody in between, what do you hope the takeaways will be from these 10 stories?
Well, the main thesis of the book is that to really develop character, you have to confront your own brokenness. Mm. That we live in an era where we're told how wonderful we are, like we have this golden self inside, and we just have to listen to ourselves, be true to ourselves. But the people in the book identified their core sin. And that's a word that's somewhat problematic in society now. You're not really allowed to talk about sin. I talked about my book on Charlie Rose even before it came out, and I got a call from an editor in New York of a different publishing house, and he said, I love the way you talk about your sin, I mean, your book, but don't use the word sin, use the word insensitive. And for a lot of people, the word sin is off-putting, and insensitive, that's not sin. And so one of the stories I tell in the book is Dwight Eisenhower. When he was 9, he wanted to go trick-or-treating. His mom, who was this remarkable woman named Ida, wouldn't let him. He threw a temper tantrum, and he punched the tree, and he rubbed off all the skin on his fingers. And his mom sent him to his room, let him cry for an hour, and recited a verse, which was from Proverbs, he that conquers his own soul is greater than he who taketh the city. Mm. And when he wrote his memoir 6 years later, Eisenhower said that was the most important conversation of his life. Mm. Because it taught him that he had this weakness, this rage. And he spent the rest of his life conquering it, and he did do that. And so that was really the thesis of the book. Since the book's come out, I've come to recognize that that's too individualistic a view of what makes these people great. And that what they all had, in retrospect, I didn't realize this while I was writing it, was they had amazing moms. Mm. Their dads were eh. But, but they had amazing moms. And I came across a study recently. All these men were drafted in the Army in World War II. And some rose to major, some stayed private or whatever. And they said, what do the people who rose to major have? And it wasn't physical courage that correlated to it. It wasn't intelligence. It was relationship with mother. Mm. Because those men had been, great love had been poured into them. And they knew what great love looked like. And when they became junior officers, they could pour great love into their men. And that helped them rise. And then the second thing the characters in the book could do was they could make amazing commitments. And so I've come to believe, and really this is going to be my next book, that to lead a fulfilled life, you have to be able to make 4 great commitments well. To spouse and family, to a philosophy or faith, to a community and to a vocation. And every single person in this book not only conquered themselves, but they were capable of deeply fierce attachments, sometimes decades long. One of the characters I write about in the book is Dorothy Day, a personal favorite of mine. And she was the sort of person who would read novels, and she didn't just read them, she acted them out. She lived like the character she was reading about. And unfortunately, she read a lot of Dostoevsky. So she's drinking a lot, carousing a lot, really suicide attempts, really a very disorganized life. But she gave birth, and at that moment, she wrote a great description of what childbirth feels like from a mother's point of view. And she wrote, if I had written the greatest symphony, composed the greatest novel, or sculpted the greatest sculpture, I could not have felt the more exalted creator than I did when they placed my child in my arms. Mm. I had never felt such a vast flood of love and joy after the birth of my child. With that came a need to worship and to adore. And she felt sudden this wave of gratitude over her. And she needed to thank something for this, and she found God at that moment. And she spent the rest of her life as a Catholic worker, shutting her newspaper, founding soup kitchens, homeless shelters, 60 years of, you know, that long obedience in the same direction. And out of that, it wasn't always a joyful life, but there were moments of joy. And moments when you can actually go on YouTube and look at videos of her at the end of her life on TV getting interviewed, and there's a spareness and a directness and a really a beauty to the way she talked and to her moral commitments.
So she's a great example for our School of Social Work.
Yeah.
In all that she did. In the book, you juxtapose what you call resume virtues and eulogy virtues, but they're both categories of virtues. Explain what you mean.
Before I do that, let me indulge me for 1 second.
You need a Dr. Pepper?
No. I always need one, but but that. So when you write a book, there's only one name on the cover, and there's someone, but it's always the joint product of a bunch of people. And it would give me pleasure that the person who really co-wrote it and co-researched it with me is in the room. She lives in Houston, and her name is Ann Snyder. And you don't often get to publicly acknowledge the person whose work you've stolen from so liberally. And I'd just like to ask Ann to stand up for 1 second.
Yes, can we have the lights up? Can you see her?
I could see, but I couldn't see. Okay. The book was really going to be about cognitive humility. It was going to be about intellectual humility. But Anne went to this college called Wheaton College, a Christian school outside of Chicago, and came armed with a curriculum of moral improvement, which I needed. And that literature and our work together, and especially her research on Dorothy Day, sort of shifted the whole book. I probably should give her more of the royalties. So the idea, the distinction between the eulogy and the resume is that the resume virtues are the things we bring to the marketplace, whether we're good at being a lawyer or a teacher or doctor, whatever it is. And then the eulogy virtues are the things they say about us after we're dead, whether we're capable of courage, honesty, honor, great love. And we all know the eulogy virtues are more important. We'd all like to be known for those things. But we live in a culture that emphasizes the resume virtues, that, and an educational system that, frankly, teaches people how to have a great career. And a lot of us are clearer on how to build a career than how to build our character. And I find in many of the students, both at Yale where I teach, but around the country, they obsess about career, the anxiety about the career, and no vocabulary for their inner life. And I find that's true in adults. I would go on book tour around the country talking about the book, and sometimes I'd find myself in a convention center in some city, and I'm at a convention of business people. And I walk in a room with 100 CEOs, and they're basically all 62-year-old white men. And they've been talking about healthcare costs and quarterly returns and the most material of business topics. And I walk in there, and I'm about to give them a speech about love and Dorothy Day and grace and redemption. And I walk into the room, and it's chilly. And I think, this is not going to go well. And then when I start talking about sin and about joy and about what one's highest and deepest and best life is, with a few exceptions, they just lock in. And there's a hunger in the culture for a language that has fallen away. And I say, I feel like a sprinkler system in the desert. You don't have to be good because they just lock in. The only place where I don't feel that hunger, when I come in, where I just have them immediately, there's a quality of their silence. Because there's something they know they're missing. We're all born with this moral desire for holiness. And that desire has been unfilled. The only place I don't have that easy access is at Christian colleges. Because they're like, yeah, we do this every day. And so I have to up my game.
Yeah.
But
Well, we do emphasize the eulogy virtues here. We don't ignore the resume virtues, but it's one of the things that we take satisfaction here, but it's also a challenge to make sure that we are emphasizing what T.S. Eliot called the permanent things, the things that endure.
Yeah, the commitments, the problem with making them is that to marry someone, to choose a vocation, that thing will change you. Mm. And so to have kids, after you have kids, you won't be the same human being you were before. So how do you decide if that's right for you? There's a philosophy problem called the vampire problem. Suppose somebody came up to you and said, would you like to become a vampire? You know, you get to live forever, fly around at night, you wouldn't have to drink human blood, you could, you know, cows could donate blood for you, you'd be fine. How would you make that decision? Because you wouldn't know what it felt like to be a vampire. And there's no going back. And so we're all faced with these major decisions that you can't rationalize your way through. You can't think your way into it. The only way to get over the hurdle into making a commitment is by enlarging the heart and through love. And so arousing in students' minds, giving them things to love, creating an atmosphere of beauty which draws them forward in a spirit of loveliness, giving them moments of awe, connecting to the liberal arts which will give them, will widen their repertoire of emotions. Just that what I find that because it's a Christian schools, love is at center stage. At a lot of research universities, we're treated simply as intellectual creatures and the soul is behind a curtain. And so as a result, the student, we're guiding our students in every way except the most important features of life. And so I look at some of the schools like this one, and I, you know, a lot of Christians frankly feel they're off on the margins of society. But I look at the way these schools educate the whole person and think you're on the vanguard of society because you've got what everyone else is seeking. Which is a way to talk about the heart, the soul, and the mind, all in one package.
Thank you. I think that deserves a round of applause.
Thank you. That was wonderful.
To shift to one of his early books, this is about 15 years old. It is called Bobos in Paradise. May seem like many of you are familiar with it, many of you have read it. When I read the book, I was astonished at how I had missed these social and cultural and educational developments that essentially a social and cultural revolution had occurred. I had seen it but not perceived it. You caught it. It was a magnificent insight into who we are and who we had become over the course of, say, 50 years. First of all, what's a Bobo? And explain your thesis, if you would, in this wonderful book.
A Bobo
Bobos in Paradise.
Is a bourgeois bohemian, someone who has 60s values and 90s money. And so I had lived in Europe for 5 years. I came back and found this new culture, which was like Restoration Hardware, Whole Foods. My joke is that Whole Foods is a progressive grocery store where all the cashiers look like they're on loan from Amnesty International. And the other big joke I tell about that one is my favorite section is the snack food section, because pretzels and potato chips would be too vulgar, so they have these seaweed-based snacks called, we get veggie booty with kale for kids who come home and say, Mom, I want a snack that'll help prevent colorectal cancer. And so I found this sort of upscale style. And some of it was consumerist, like there was a certain code of ethics that it was, you could spend any amount of money on any room formerly used by the servants. So you could spend a ton of money on your kitchens, but not on your living rooms. What you wanted was a lot of texture. You wanted your bread to be dense, your fabrics to be nubby. And so it was a style of being rich in a way that was not classically materialistic. Unfortunately, it's still around. The Restoration Hardware ethos, the anthropology ethos, it's still sort of the dominant mode of Silicon Valley and upper middle class suburbs around the country. You know, like you have to buy a luxury car, but you buy an Audi or a Saab or a Volvo because you can. It's socially acceptable to get a luxury car, so long as it's from the country hostile to U.S. foreign policy. That's fine. And so a new social code had arisen, and it was really about that. About people. If anybody reads my newspaper's wedding pages, it's about people who put their weddings in there. They call it the mergers and acquisitions page. So, Goldman Sachs marries Skadden Arps. Harvard marries Princeton, magna cum laude marries magna cum laude. You never see a magna cum laude marrying a summa cum laude because the tensions would be too great. And so it's about the rise of that upscale culture. Austin.
Bobo, bourgeois bohemian. So we may have a number of us here in the audience tonight. So such a great observer. I want to shift then and to pick up on some of your wonderful observations. But religion in America, there seem to be competing views. Are we becoming, as a society, not just Hollywood or what have you, or television, secular? And recently, one of our colleagues here at Baylor, the renowned sociologist, Rodney Stark, published, and this is recently out, a book entitled The Triumph of Faith, Why the World is More Religious Than Ever, going against the conventional wisdom that secularism is on the rise, is on the march. Religion in America, faith in America, you're observing every single day. What's your take?
I actually think faith will play a larger role in world affairs for the next 100 years. That's certain. The flock of the faithful is growing. That's partly just, you look at sociology, that's partly just fertility. Religious people have more children. There's never been a secular society in the history of the world that has had replacement level births. And so faith is growing. The second thing that I think is growing in this country is respect and desire. Now, of course, there has been these issues on gay marriage and other things like that. At the same time, I just discern this spiritual hunger. And I would say when I go out, I'm very unvarnished in talking about St. Augustine and in talking about Dorothy Day, and not only just talking about them, but talking about the Lord who motivated them and around whom their lives were pinioned. And I was been amazed in the last year since this book came out at how little pushback I get and how much genuine admiration there is. And so to me, the Christian world has an opportunity to remedy the culture. And as someone who circles around the Christian world quite a lot, inside and out, I did a talk at a place called The Gathering, where it seemed to me that the Christian world builds ramps that welcome people in and erects walls that keep people out. And the ramps are sometimes just joyous Christians. It's sometimes the ability to talk comfortably about spiritual matters in a way nobody else can, to talk about society in a way that is filled with heart and soul. The walls are often the product of a weird combination of an intellectual inferiority complex combined with a spiritual superiority complex. And that sometimes means not the highest intellectual standards. At the same time, the searchers can be looked down upon. Sometimes there's invasive care. Sometimes being Christian seems to be a permission slip to get in each other's lives in inappropriate ways. And then, to me, the great opportunity is to shift the outward personality of the faith and the people. For one reason or another, and for reasons that are well understood, Christianity became known to outsiders for its views on sex. And those views are part of the faith, and I understand that. But Christianity and the Christian community could be known for what is more central, frankly, to the faith, which is the care and tending of the poor and seeing the face of Jesus in the lives of the poor. And if that were the outward face, then we have a very different culture and a very different story. And so as we react to decisions having to do with gay marriage and such, I would just encourage, for the good of the country, if we saw people of all denominations projecting out the Dorothy Day face, projecting out the service to the poor, the things that are already done within these communities, but for some reason have been diverted by the culture war over sex. And to me, that is a great potential, and there would be a great hunger for that, because we're in a society that is politics rich but meaning poor. And the searching for meaning is what I confront every day. And the Christian community has a model and a surplus of meaning, which is God's continuing love and care for us and active energy in our world.
Thank you. Yes. Beautiful. David, that sounded very consistent with the vision lifted up by folks like Rick Warren. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. I don't like the shirts, but I do agree with Rick.
yeah, he wears Hawaiian shirts.
Yeah, and two friends of mine, I would recommend if anybody wants to Google this, two close friends of mine, Mike Gerson and Pete Wehner, wrote a piece, a cover story on Christianity Today about 4 or 5 months ago on this subject, which I recommend if anybody wants to Google.
Well, let's go global. We're just about to turn to questions from you. We want you to join the conversation, and questions have been picked up by our wonderful Baylor ambassadors, so we want to thank our ambassadors for being here this evening. And the Christian community has been responding to this as well. The Syrian refugee crisis. Last year alone, more than 1 million refugees, according to official records, actually risked their lives, including crossing the Mediterranean to get to that island of Lesbos from off the Turkish coast. And currently there are almost 5 million registered Syrian refugees. This has been very controversial. Angela Merkel now struggling a bit with us with the issue. In your view, how should the West respond, and in particular, how should the United States respond?
Yeah, I mean, I think the cornerstone of our view is, it's not brain science. We care for the downtrodden. We just care for the oppressed. And the stories of those tumbling barrel bombs, the horrific, you know, when you have a society where you get hundreds of thousands killed over a short period of time, you've got masses of people who have been inflicted with trauma. And so they're fleeing, of course. Now, it doesn't mean we take them all in. It doesn't mean we can't be afforded. But it seems to me we don't sit idly by while that happens. I've had so many friends who are the survivors of genocides in Rwanda and in other places, or the Holocaust. And it is the case in every single one of those, afterwards we always feel shame and guilt that we didn't do more to stop. And so I guess what I would have done, and this was a problem, more of a solution 5 years ago than it is now, was to establish safe havens within Syria itself where people could go. That's not a total solution, but it prevents the mass immigration and the popular reaction against. I still think that's a large part of the solution, create places within Syria itself where people can go and live with some safety. But I do think taking some people in, housing some people, at least temporarily, is just an obligation of sympathy and compassion. When you travel around as much as I do, and I'm sure all of us have had this feeling going abroad, you know, we just won the lottery being born here. And that could have been us. And so I do think, the practicalities of it aside, that should be our initiating posture.
Thank you. Join me in thanking David Brooks, and now we look forward to your question.
Thank you, Mr. Brooks and Judge Starr, for such a meaningful thoughtful, inspiring conversation. I don't know about you, but a couple of times I had tears in my eyes. So thank you for this. Throughout the evening, you have submitted outstanding questions. Unfortunately, we're only going to be able to ask a few. We can't ask all of them. We have a large stack. But we will be asking a few. And joining me, my colleagues from the President's office, Dominic Edwards and Allie Mosier, will come now and ask the questions of Mr. Brooks.
Mr. Brooks, thank you for being with us tonight. Our first question, what is your best piece of writing advice?
Avoid it. I'm going to say, for the first two things, first I'll mention two authors who I recommend. And the first will be very familiar to this audience, which is C.S. Lewis. The second is George Orwell. They both wrote for radio, and therefore there was clarity in their minds. And Lewis would never use a big word when a small one would do. And Orwell was just this great master of the opening sentence, among other things. His essay, people are famous with his novels. His essays are masterpieces. Here's one called Shooting the Elephant. There's Such, Such Were the Joys about being in a boarding school in England. He writes that in the first sentence. He says something like, 3 weeks after I came to this school, not immediately, but sort of shortly thereafter, I began wetting the bed. That's just a good first sentence. You want to know what's going on. There was another story. He wrote an essay called The Lion and the Unicorn about being English. And he wrote it while the bombs were coming down during the Blitz of London. And he wrote, high above my head, highly civilized human beings are flying planes and trying to kill me. And that's just a good sentence. It pulls you in simply. The one thing I'll say about my writing style, and everyone has, writing is about traffic management, it's about organization and structure. And so I have a very bad memory. And so I write everything down on pieces of paper, and I print out big stacks of papers with notes and information. And then I go to my carpet, which is like this one in the living room, my place, and I separate all the papers into piles on the floor. And each pile is a paragraph of my column. And there might be 14 piles for an 800-word column. But to me, the writing process is not the part where you're typing it into the computer. It's laying out the piles, crawling around on the floor, laying out the piles. And sometimes when you're moving fast and putting things in different piles, new connections are occurring to you, you're writing notes to yourself, and that is when the writing happens. And sometimes it's just joyous and exciting because you're coming up, it's all fitting together, you know this is going to work, and it feels like prayer. It's my form of prayer. And so that would be my advice. Pay attention to structure. Don't sit down to write until your structure is completely done and your article is 80% done. The writing part is just the icing on the cake.
Our next question. When did compromise become a dirty word? Is there any way to change that?
No, that's when what I was saying about people with democracy is about managing diversity. And even in politics, not many people have power. You've got to manage diversity. It's like being a school president. And so you have to herd the sheep. And it's about understanding where they're coming from. But now we elect people who say, I will never compromise. I won't work with those people. I mean, the state of Texas has been known to elect a person of that sort. Politics is a noble profession. I meet with these people all the time. And most of the people in Washington, we send to Washington, are in it for the right reasons. Their life is not that glamorous. You fly out of D.C. on a Thursday night when Congress is adjourning and they're all flying home, senators up front, House members in the back, and they're landing and then they've got to drive an hour to get home, and then they come back and they're voting and they're fundraising. It's just not a glamorous lifestyle. They're doing it because they think they can make some good for the country. And they happen to be stuck in a rotten system, which most of them hate. And when you go to lunch with them, you always come away thinking, better in private than in public. That in private, they're intelligent and subtle and important and just impressive. And it's our system that's dumb. And Walter Lippmann is a columnist who in the 20s, who said they hide their virtues and publicize their vices. Mm. That's often true of our politicians. And yet, for students, I would encourage a life of public of government service. The people in government are living in a crowded hour at intensity. I have a friend, she's in government now, and she says, you know, every day sucks, but the overall experience is tremendously rewarding. And I think that's often true. And, you know, Mike Gerson, who I mentioned, wrote this article. He helped President Bush design the anti-HIV policy, which I'm now blanking on the name. And so Mike Gerson, helped save probably 10 million people in Africa. I had lunch with a guy named Richard Darman, who was budget director under the first President Bush. He was running two companies at the time, CEO of two big companies. And he said, I've got these two big jobs, I'm busy, but none of my days are as consequential as every day was in government. Because you just got big numbers to move around, and it's intense. And so I think we have a rotten system that is completely dysfunctional. But I do think the craft of paying attention to other people and reaching workable compromises should not be disdained as sort of selling out, which is what's happened in the public sphere.
What background and preparation do you think prepares a person to be a journalist who can speak with insight and understanding?
How the heck should I know? I'll tell you what prepares people to be a journalist. So every profession has its personality type. And so for activism, you got to love people, or for politics. Like, we need food, water, sleep. They need people. My joke is they stand too close. They invade your personal space. They'll rub your cheek as they're talking to you. They just, like, physically. One of my stories is I was walking down the street in Aspen, Colorado, one summer because I wanted to get in touch with the real America. And I see a bunch of Secret Service agents, so I'm checking out to see who they're guarding, and it's Bill Clinton. And so I walk up to him, and he's watching a high school jazz band play, and he's telling me how great the saxophonist this kid apparently is. And because he's Clinton, he can't just talk to me. He has to knead it into me, like his arm around me, and because I'm me, I'm sort of cowering away. And so we move like 40 yards across the sidewalk as the song is playing. So they, you know, politicians just love human contact. Journalists are a little different. Journalists are not enacting change, we're just sitting off and observing it. And so to have an aloof personality is not disadvantageous in journalism. And so my joke is if you're at a football game and everybody's standing up and doing the wave, and you're the sort of person who just sits there and doesn't do the wave, then you could be a journalist. And the other thing is, Anne and I were working together in the New York Times, and we can tell you there are a lot of socially awkward people. And so what journalism does is it structures social interaction. An interview is a very formal social interaction. I'm going to tell one story that I don't know if I have for permission, but I'm going to tell it anyway. So they had a potluck, a cooking. Everyone goes around and cooks lunch for everybody else. And so normal offices, you go around, everyone takes turns cooking lunch. They put some care into the cooking. They bring in a meal. And you sit around and eat it together. At our office, Anne brought in a meal. Everybody grabbed it, went back to their desk. Where are we working? What is? So social awkwardness is part of it. But the other thing is the great advantage of it is you don't get to lead change, but you get to be around it. And so by the time I was 40, I'd interviewed Yeltsin, Thatcher, Reagan. I mean, all these amazing people. And you know, there are two great interviews I had. Probably the two best of my life. The best was Jackie Gleason, probably the funniest person I've ever met in my life. And then the second was I was covering the decline of the Soviet Union, and if you remember, there was a coup, and Boris Yeltsin stood on a tank and stood up to the coup plotters. And I was out there on the lawn, and I ran into a woman who was 92 passing out sandwiches to the democracy protesters. And she had been friends with the Tsar. Her first husband had been killed in the Civil War after the Russian Revolution. Her second husband was sent to the Gulag. Two of her children died in the Battle of Stalingrad. She was a member of the Kalmyk people, and they were forcibly moved by Khrushchev out of their homeland, basically into Siberia. And so she, over the course of one life, had experienced every phase of Soviet history. And there she was in her 90s handing out sandwiches at the Soviet Union collapse. And you just get these lives that are just amazing. And you get to interact with people like that.
And for our last question, what advice do you have to offer to the young people, to the students in the crowd this evening?
One, I'm going to come up with random stuff. Invest most of your money in lottery tickets. No, I'm kidding. The thing you'll remember from here most, aside from the fine education and the spiritual growth, is your friends. And students have a tendency to underinvest in friendship because they're busy with papers they got to get done. And so invest heavily in your friends and stay with your friends. Second, the first year out of college, your first 5 years out will be very challenging. You're in a very structured environment where your friendship circles and are all sort of pre-made. Highly intelligent people are paid to pay attention to you and read what you write. That will never happen again. So you're going to be thrown out of this world of complete lack of structure. There'll be moments of unemployment, moments of romantic breakdown. That's why your friends are really important. But your first year out is the year when you will, maybe for life, define your horizon of risk. You do something really crazy, and your horizon of risk will be out here for all those years. You do something conventional that doesn't really challenge your assessment of risk, and forever after, your life will be in this zone of risk. And so I think it's important. You know, my eldest joined the Israeli army, and that's like a pretty radical shift from living in Bloomington, Indiana. And it's been moments of challenge, moments of stretching, moments of growth. But one of the things he says is, you know, I'm not going to go back to an office job. Because his horizon, his risk is out here. And he knows he can take it, whatever gets thrown at him. I work with one and used to work with the other, two wonderful men on Friday nights, Mark Shields and Jim Lehrer. And they're both Marines, and they were proud of their careers, but they're most proud of the Marine Corps. And Larry used to say, one of the things the Marine Corps taught me is that I could get punched in the face and it was no big problem. And so widening that horizon of risk, I think, is such an important thing, because there are forces in society who want to suck you into a narrow horizon. And then they will reward you with money, and then you'll be 45 and you'll think, I really don't know what my vocation is. And so keeping your heart open for that vocation, that would be, I feel like a pompous jerk, but that's my advice.
That was political commentator David Brooks in conversation with Baylor President Ken Starr for the On Topic series. This is 103.3 KWBU FM Waco.